this work on mixed norm with entropy. It's nice to be here and to see all these kind of different overlaps between QIT and operator spaces or operator algebras. And so let me start with something on the simple side, because often, I mean, as we have seen in Ed's talk, you have to start with a commutative picture and then someone understand that. And if you understand this really well, then maybe you can get something out of it. So that's the strategy of this talk here. So I will really do it a little bit too easy. I apologize for all the non-commutative people. I'll just talk about classical channels, because the ideas are a little bit simpler. And so what is that? That's a positive map, positive preserving and state preserving, right? So positive, of course, a positive function sent to a positive function. I never get that straight. So where should I put here? Okay. Yeah, so positive preserving and then state preserving. A state is, of course, one where the sum of the coordinates are equal to 1, and then I really don't like these kind of pointers too much. Anyway, so this is a channel, a classical channel, very, very boring classical channel. And so these are the properties, and you can rewrite it in matrices, right? I mean, it's a family, it's a matrix where summation AJK is 1 for every, well, probably should be a K. But anyway, so positive matrices with the summation condition. And then, now I made a mistake, I have to do this green button. Okay. So then the entropy is defined as the summation Sk minus Lnk of a state. And what I want to show is essentially what I want to give is a little sketch of the additivity of entropy in this commutative, easy, baby setting, okay? So the trick here is, and that's why we get somewhere into this picture, is that the entropy can be derived as differentiating the LP norm, okay? So the LP norm is the summation Sk to the power P1 over P, that's the standard LP norm, and if you differentiate it at P equals 1, you get exactly the entropy, and you can do this exercise by yourself. That's really calculus, right? I mean, so the point is we are doing this for state. We are not really differentiating the absolute value. Good point, because if not, you would actually have to be a little bit more careful with the absolute value. But for states where you have positive coefficients and where this here is 1, this is very easy to see. So this is how we get the entropy. And the minimum entropy of a channel, my channel now here is denoted by T for a second, it's just the minimal entropy where I minimize over all states. And then if you interchange differentiation and taking the minimum, you obtain the following formula. So we are calculating minus of the entropy, that's the typical thing here. So this would be the max of all F, and then we differentiate this norm, and then we interchange these norms. So in fact, we can just differentiate the norm of T from L1 to LP, evaluate it at P, and that's minus the entropy. Yeah. So this is kind of the basic setup which we want to use, and then we want to use this. I think I just even gave the norm of a map here, because we might have different spaces and different norms, so that's the definition. And now we want to see what are the properties of these LP norms which you have to use in order to prove such kind of theorems, right? I mean, this is what I'm interested in. And the right question here is not, well, what are the specific norms, but what are the properties? I mean, this kind of really abstract properties on these LP spaces which relate to this kind of question. That's what I want to understand. And so for that, you have to introduce not only LP spaces, but LP of LQ spaces, because the whole trick is somehow related to flipping around tensors. We all like tensors, flipping tensors, a very nice operation. But here we have, the whole point is that we have different norms involved. So LP of LQ, oh, that should be So we take the summation over Aij to the Q, P over Q, 1 over P. This should be, now I can use this here, for those who, this is a P, right? So P is outside, Q is inside. And so that's a very easy operation, right? We just take the LP norms of the Q norms. And then we observe some very elementary properties, which are, you know, exercises. These are really exercises. So LP of LQ is an LQ of LP if Q is larger than P, right? I mean, think of L1 of L infinity is an L infinity of L1, right? That's the way it works. But if you, I mean, this is how, if you see in a, look in a Banach space book, you will see this all the time. But you have to note that this is actually flipping the order. I mean, it's Aij goes to Aji. Yeah, but with this inclusion, we have LP of LQ and LQ of LP. And this is really very, very simple because it's a triangle inequality in LP over Q. And so, in LQ over P, and so we are good. So we need this inclusion. LP of LQ is an LQ of LP. And then we need another property of a channel, which is, in this particular case, true for every linear map. It's not the business of being positive or not. It's true for every linear map. Namely, if you have a map which goes from LQ1 to LQ2 and you tensor with identity on LP, that this is the same as the norm. You know? And if you think about the definition up there, you're just doing this coordinate-wise, so this norm equality is really just coordinate-wise. It's very easy. I think I tried to write this down, but in fact, identity tensor theory is much clearer than writing it down in coordinates, so as you probably will all agree. So now let's prove the this theorem here, the multiplicativity of the corresponding norms. So I mean here we are doing a well-known route. We are trying to prove the entropy by first proving a multiplicative result for the norms. And so for every two maps from LP to LQ and another one from LP to LQ, I put N and N just to somehow distinguish the different dimensions and also to distinguish whether they have different size. And I want to show that these two norms are the same. Oh, I like this. This is really more robust. So let's go to the proof here. And as I said before, I have this flip map. Aij goes to Aji. So the flip map is x tender y goes to y tender x. And then I think I still have this here on my other blackboard. I can always do identity tensor T is the same as the norm. So I'm doing this here. So I do this for identity tensor S, right? Here, identity tensor T, LP of NN, that's of course LP of N of LP of M. And then I go, usually I would go to LP of LQ, but since I flipped, I go to LQ of LP. Yeah, so I'm using this estimate plus this estimate together here, right? So first applying identity tensor S and then flipping, that can be estimated by the norm of S. What I can do for S, I can do for T. The only thing is, I should somehow start on the same space. So now I'm starting on LQ of LP, obviously, right? I mean, we want to compose two things at the end. And if I do that, then I can write the tensor as two flips, right? I mean, I'm flipping twice. Everything is undone in terms of harm. But it's just the composition of these two operators, that's T tensor S. And so we proved that the norm of T tensor S is less than the norm of T times the norm of S. And the other one is easy, just plug it in. There's no question. Okay? So this is the main concept. We need essentially these two properties, LP of LQ and LQ of LP. And if I tensorize with an LP, that doesn't change the norm. Okay. And as an application, let's prove the additivity. If we take the minimal energy of S tensor T, so here the choice of S is not very lucky, I agree, but we're just differentiating T tensor S, that's by definition, but now we are using that this norm here is a product of these two norms, and then we use the chain rule, right? If you have the product of two functions, you want to differentiate. Of course, you keep one and differentiate. So it's really elementary chain rule, and that's exactly what it happens. Here we get this yeah, I want a different, I think this P equals 1 should be here. But anyway, we are differentiating the product, and then we get 1 times the differential times 1, and then this is the only place, by the way, where we use channel, the norm from L1 to L1 is 1. Yeah, because it's trace preserving, and then the norm from L1 to L1 is 1, and we get minus this, minus that. So this is kind of the model. That's what we want to imitate. Of course, we know it's not really going to work because we have these wonderful results, but anyway, I mean, this is still a nice model, but of course it's also not really enough because we somehow want to talk about the non-commutative version. And so let me just write down what the abstract properties is. We need a family of spaces, VP, arbitrary spaces, a family of norms on linear maps between these spaces so that two properties are satisfied. VP of VQ is contained in VQ of VP, so we are thinking of tensor products of these spaces. Yeah? And that if I use if I tensor with one of these VR spaces, then the norm is preserved. Now, I'm saying this is not necessarily the original operator norm. This is just any norm. I can just put any norm there, and whenever I do that, I have kind of an abstract minimal entropy theorem. Right? Whenever I take the norm from V1 to VP, differentiate that as P equals 1, then this abstract minimal and entropy is additive. Right, for tensor products. So this is kind of that's kind of a nice feature. We just have to find nice spaces and then everything is good. Yes, I that's the other observation. I just need this in a small neighborhood around 1. But in fact, and I don't think this is completely explored, 1 here is not particularly important either. Right? I mean, we could differentiate that for every, I don't even know what that gives. I mean, we could do this for every LP, P bigger than 1, and differentiate from LP to a little bit bigger, right? As long as the norm from LP to LP is 1, the same argument would work. So this is an abstract thing which I just specified for the parameter 1, but that's not necessary at all. It's really kind of a Gleizig scheme.
You want P less
than Q? Sure. Sure, I mean, I need this P less than Q here, right? That's the same assumption as above. Exactly, thank you. Okay, so this is our scheme. And now, I was just in Marseille. I really couldn't stop taking this photo. So that's our next step. And then this moves over here. So now we just do everything quantized as an ad talk. We replace channels by completely positive maps on matrix algebras, right? Mn is B of H. And we have trace preserving. That's not, and states are just densities. Yeah, so this is our language problem. Actually, So, and then the minimal, the entropy of an F, I mean, before this was denoted by rho, it's just exactly minus trace of F ln F, and then it's the same thing here. The P norm is the trace of F to the power P 1 over P. We differentiate it at P equals 1. It's exactly the same. There's no change here. Okay? And then the minimal energy is exactly this one. And then we could somehow try to copy the same scheme, but it does fail, right? We all know that by now. We cannot have it all because we know that these norms here are not multiplicative due to Petrick, and even worse, the entropy is not additive. So here we have no chance of copying the old stuff. So this actually means in this kind of very abstract thing, we cannot find a good norm which satisfies our axioms with this LP of LQ business, and the identity tensor phi is the thing here. But if you come from the theory of operator spaces, then assuming that this year identity on LP of L1 is the same thing as the norm, this is just highly unlikely. So it's clear that if we have a choice, one has to give. So for me, that's the choice, right? But anyway, you could actually try to modify your spaces, but I think you cannot have both, so you have to probably probably this is the right thing. On the other hand, you can try this with different notions of spaces. So we have this kind of variable methods. We can just find nice norms on these tensor products with nice properties and then see what we get. I mean, of course, we did this before knowing that it doesn't work, but that's the charm of the thing. And so here are the norms I'm familiar with, PDH norms. So I should say something about this. So we had this introduction to operator spaces. And I really liked Carlos' title. Operator space here is a language. It's like a calculus. We can, you know, if you have a map from T from X to Y, the norm of T is the same as the norm of T star. There are just a couple of rules. And for this audience, it would probably be nice if somebody writes an overview article, what are the 10 rules you need, because you don't need more in 99% of the cases. And then if you need more, then you have to ask an expert anyway. So but there are very few things which are actually needed. But these LP of LQ spaces, they bury some properties of operators in there which are non-trivial. And these properties come essentially from the concept of analytic functions. You will not see any analytic function in the whole talk, but the point is some of these properties come from factorization of analytic functions. That's where some of these hard arguments come from. And suddenly it looks like a big block with a big surprise, but that's the whole point. And some of them are buried in these kind of different definitions. So I'm using LP of LQ in the sense of PDA. Actually, he wrote SP of SQ with these brackets. It seems like we have two different definitions. So let's explain that. The norm in LP of LQ for P less than Q is given as the infimum of an element in LQ and two elements in L2S, so that X is A tensor 1, Y B tensor 1. Now, if you could do this for the commutative LP of LQ norms, and then you can write down this A would be just on one side. It's very, very, very elementary. Essentially, do the summation, the norms. I mean, it's very elementary. But here, there is actually a virtue of doing this two-sided. And this parameter S is just made to make it work. 1 over P is 1 over Q plus 1 over... It's just in order to make the spaces be all right. I mean, you don't really have a choice here. So for P less than Q, that is the norm, which has at least the advantage of being algebraic. I mean, it has a factorization property. So some calculations, you can use this factorization property. For instance, if X is positive, you can make this Y be positive and A being B star. And that comes immediately from the definition. Just rewrite it and somehow, I mean, who said that? Polar decomposition? This is what is behind. So you use some polar decomposition and then you can see that for positive X, that is the same thing. And for P less than Q, it goes the other way around. Now the int becomes the sup. Also something we have already seen in this talk, the sup int business. And in fact, one can, the real definition is one where sup equals an int. And that is the fact which we use from analytic functions. But I don't really want to dwell on this. The point is that if you accept the LQ spaces and the LP spaces, you can at least write down these objects. I'm not saying that calculating any of these norms is ever simple, except for trivial cases, but anyway. So, and then the main property which we need here is the following. So if we define the triple norm of T to be identity tensor P from LQ, LP1 to LQ, LP2, and I'm taking supremum over M in order to make it, you know, finite dimensional, but that's not really necessary. So the triple norm here, a priori, if you look at this definition, might depend on Q, right? I mean, but it doesn't. And that's operator space theory. Yeah, so the fact that this does not depend, but in fact, it's not super difficult even to calculate this from these elementary properties most of the time. But the point is that's the black box which we are accepting. This norm here does not depend on Q, and in fact, in our theory, it's just called the CD norm of T. Yeah, and you see, this makes sense. if we have different range of indices, we don't have to assume P1 equals P2. They can float all over the place. And they're, of course, very different from what you're used to, the CB norms, where you just tensor. And the point is, if you just brutally tensor, then since you have different indices, things do not really match up. So we don't have a choice. So this is our, these are the properties. And then we have some features. And so these are things one should have in mind if you want to understand these norms. So the Minkowski inequality, well, that's, so LP of LQ is contained in LQ of LP. You're probably not surprised to hear that that's true. And the easiest way to prove that is what is called interpolation. It's this using analytic function. Also something we don't have to do now. I mean, it's a nice conference. We don't have to do the hard work. But we have the Minkowski inequality. We have the stability by CB norms in the sense of this equation, right? I mean, if we tensor with some LQ space, it doesn't change the norm. The CB norm is preserved. We have duality. I mean, that's of course one of the real big things about operator spaces is that duality works, right? I mean, Ed explained that. So you have a function system, and then the dual is what? So for operator spaces, the dual is something. Now, the point is, the dual might be very complicated if you really want to present it on some V of H. True, but the point is that it's in the same category, and you can actually just work with it. It's enough. You don't care how it is represented. It just has these abstract functorial properties. You can do tensor products, you can calculate norms, you can calculate CB norms in and out, and that's all you need. You don't really want to know what is the operator space structure. You want to know what can I do with it. And then I come back to my list of 10 rules, which I'm probably never going to figure out exactly, but anyway. So, and then there are some nice properties. For instance, if phi is bounded and completely positive, it not only preserves, you know, this is phi tensor identity, so this is the other way, a preservation property. Right? I forgot the tensor identity here, tensor identity. So I transform the LP space, at least the LQ space on the other side inside, and then you still have the norm equation. This is actually not totally trivial. You have to use some representation theory of completely maps to prove this, but it's nice. It's very comforting. And then, of course, somehow in the other direction, now I'm going down, large to small, we have the tensor product property, phi tensor phi tilde, from LP MN squared to LQ MN squared. So even if the indices, I mean, that for P equals Q equals infinity, that says that the CB norm of phi tensor phi tilde is the CB norm of phi times the CB norm of phi tilde. This is true as long as you go down. Yeah, but if you go up, that's a different story. But here, you need completely positivity. That's very important. If not, I cannot show this. And the real heart of the method is this interpolation. This is just really method. And the real deal is the Hagerup tensor product, which is hidden. You know, this is in the definition of the norm. If you really have to learn it, you have to first start with the Hagerup tensor product. If you don't want to learn it, then you don't. Okay. So what is the result? Of course, the CB entropy, the differentiation of the CB norm at P equals 1 is additive, right? That's after what we all said, this is a family of basis VP, which satisfies all the properties, so it's trivial, right? This is how we actually started. And then we try to understand what it actually means, which is not a trivial question. But the proof now is, well, we have LP of LQ is an LQ of LP. We have the preservation by the norm. Right? This is this equation, and we're done. The only problem we have to somehow understand is that the identity challenge has a negative entropy, which is a feature or whatever. It is at least something one cannot avoid. I think. Okay. So there is something we also have to discuss. Let me go back just a little bit. So you see, when I So there is an important connection between, of course. I mean, because if we want to calculate some of these norms, then we have a channel, and sometimes we interpret a channel as an element in the tensor product. And that can be confusing if you're not used to it. It's kind, again, a language kind of problem. But the right way to see that in this context is really the Choi matrix. So no big surprise here. So we have a map. Given a channel C, we can define a map X, an MN tensor MN, which is the Choi matrix. And of course, for those who don't like matrix units, they can write it like that. These are matrix units, right? So then, actually, you know, I really have to say that I'm really enjoying these kind of different roots of completely positive maps here and Stein spring there. For me, this is really diversity. We discussed this before. It's actually so nice that we have this in common. It's not something which separates us. It's really cool that we're talking about completely positive maps all the time and just in a slightly different context. So I'm enjoying this. So, and I wanted to give some examples. So for instance, if you take the CB map norm of a map from L1 to LP, right, the CB norm here, then this has this expression. And here you see that sometimes we have to use the language of the phi, and sometimes you have to use the language of the x, right? And this kind of this requires a little bit of gymnastics in order to translate. If you want to read PG's book and then what is the connection, this is some of these equations here. There are also more complicated expressions which look like that, and these two are the same, and that's not obvious. That is analytic function. We have two different definitions. One is really phi times identity, and the other one is the one given. And these are the same norms, right? And this is not totally obvious, but this is sometimes one can. I have, though, not really used this norm concretely, but okay. That's on. Okay. So here's the connection to capacity. So I'm giving myself a completely positive map phi, and this expression number one is exactly this one. Also not, here we have to use positivity, really. I mean, this is based on a cute, very cute trick. I think that the whole argument is just based on, if you have a positive matrix, in any P norm, or we can, maybe we should do it like this. Yeah. Which is very easy if you write this as and then you, yeah. So this is such a simple inequality, right? I mean, it's used to prove the passage from here to here. And that's true for all those. Okay. And now here is why here's where you see actually a connection to entropy and capacity. Because don't forget what we are doing. We are differentiating this expression. Oh. At t equals 1. And so if you're differentiating, this essentially meaning that we are differentiating the this here and divide by the differentiation of that, or actually with a minus. So if you do that, you get, if we denote by gamma 1, gamma 1, 2 is the whole channel. This is the image of identity phi of psi. And then we are tracing, we're slicing out one piece of this is gamma 1. Gamma 1, 2 is everything together. And if you differentiate it at p equals 1, you get, because of the minus sign, we get s of gamma 1 minus s of gamma 1, 2. So the minus comes from this part and the plus. The minus comes from, anyway, that's what, oh, here's an extra minus. Okay, so, and it was known before that if you take this expression, That is additive in gamma. And it's known that this one, where you just take this one, is not. That's coherent information, but this one is. Yeah. So the point is, once you have this concrete formula, then differentiation gets another meaning, and it's just essentially differentiating this independently and then put the right sign in it. Right? So this is very elementary, but this is kind of how one can try to interpret this inequality, which we proved by this kind of abstract means. Okay. So I should probably add some examples where you can actually calculate these norms, because calculating is not essentially easy. So I'm taking a finite group, because in quantum information theory, do something on finite algebras and finite dimensions, so why not a finite group? And the left regular representation of a unit vector EH is just E times GH, right? So it's a permutation matrix. For every finite group, this acts on its own L2 space by permutation. It's a very classical thing. And there is something which we call a trace, and that's just evaluation at the identity element. If you think this is strange, then think about the integers, which of course are not finite. Think about Fourier coefficients, summation ak e to the ik t, right, as functions. So if you integrate such a function, well, all the e to the ik t's, they are mean zero, right? You go around the circle, that's zero. The only one which is not zero is the identity function. So this is exactly the same thing as for the integers, right? It's the same kind of trace. And then associated to such a positive definite function, you can associate a channel. And I think this x here is an A. So how do we apply phi f on x? We sum over all elements g and g, f of g, lambda of g minus 1, a, lambda of g. So it's just conjugation by unitaries with these coefficients. So when we had a discussion yesterday, I thought this is obviously a convex combination of unitaries. That's not true, actually, because we are taking a positive definite function, which can have negative values. So this is not a convex combination of unitaries, because these FGs usually aren't. There are some which do, but that's a completely different story, right? I mean, it's not clear which of these guys are convex combination of unitaries. But that's another story. The nice thing about this is, if you calculate for a positive definite function, which, say, f of 1 is 1, that's the right, because if this wants to be a unital channel, then f of 1 should be 1. Yeah? So assume that f of 1 is 1, then you send a unit vector, a vector of the form 1 and 0, everything else, to itself. It's very easy to see that when you're in this condition, the classical entropy is 0, because the LP norm of that is also 1, right? I mean, unit vectors don't change in the LP norms because they are rank 1. So the classical entropy of these channels is trivial, 0. But the CV entropy is very familiar. It's exactly the trace of lambda of f, ln lambda of f, viewed as an element in this non-commutative algebra with a trace. So here the classical entropy is exactly giving the kind of entropy we are expecting, somehow for the symbol and not for the we somehow have to find the right symbol corresponding to that channel. And that's a joint result with Neufunk and Ruan, and the classical entropy is 0, and we also discovered that this actually works for all finite quantum groups. And so we would actually like to know which are the interesting quantum group representations which give interesting channels. That's one of my pet projects. And I hope to understand more, because what is really known, and that's something we discussed with David, I mean, these guys will have terrific error correction, because from the representation theory of the quantum groups, you actually know exactly which algebras are the fixed point algebras. I mean, not exactly, but you have a large algebra which is left fixed by representation theory. So this is something we would like to understand better, because we know already that the CV entropy is one of the few cases where you actually can calculate. I mean, in general, CV norms are not easy to calculate. Here, the CV norm of from L1 to LP is just the P norm of this object, and then we are just differentiating. So, yeah, but in this case, we can. Okay. And let me How much time do I have left?
15 minutes.
15 minutes. That's exactly right. So by now we have actually two competing concepts of LP of LQ norms. The one, and you might understand that I have slight preference. I presented PGA's notion first, but I want to compare it with the norm recently introduced by Carlin and Leib, which comes from the following problem, which then was solved after a long while. So now X is a positive matrix in MN tensor MN. So it's again in the tensor product state. And the somehow a naive LP of LQ norm is first take X to the Q, take the trace in one component, and then 1 over Q and the P norm. So this is kind of, if you come from the commutative case, what we do is we take the Q norm in one component and the LP norm in the other. So that's kind of the naive version of it. And if you're not careful and Q is bigger than 2, then you see immediately that this has no chance of ever being convex. But what they proved after was a very nice trick, and this was open for a long time, is that if P is less than Q is less than 2, that's okay. That is convex, right? On the space of positive axis. Okay. And so there is a Minkowski inequality. So we could start, feeding this in our machinery. The only thing when I prepared this talk, I realized that I have no idea what the corresponding C norm is supposed to be. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, with this new definition, I could start to say, okay, let's take a T and see whenever it maps LP of LQ into LP of LQ. This is a little bit this kind of question. I mean, you have a map and then you somehow consider, well, how does it map on all axes? And then you can, so something we have seen before, but I don't really know how to calculate that norm at the moment. So that might be interesting because, I mean, you have a Minkowski inequality. If you could show independence of P, then you have another entropy inequality just automatically. But this I don't know. Okay. So, and the point is, of course, this is only defined on positive elements. So I think, I haven't seen this in the original paper, but King and Colden then defined this norm as X is Y minus E. So we are taking the natural thing. If you have a cone of positive elements, you want to make it a norm, you are somehow taking the convex hull of the cone and the minus the cone. Yeah, I should do a picture. Cone like here. Then we do minus the cone. And then we do the convex hull. Right? Say, since these are unit balls, this is how it looks like. Yeah? This picture is highly misleading because it says that if I check the norm in this direction here, right, I mean, what is the smallest Minkowski norm, the smallest parameter, so that if I have a point here, what is the smallest lambda, so that I sit in here? But this is unchanged if I do this convex combination. I mean, of course, in this direction, clear, right? The situation here is somehow, I cannot draw this actually. I think in two dimension. What happens is if I do this in this particular case, the convex hull exceeds this point. I mean, it's hard to draw. But what happens is if you do the convex hull, because you have these super high dimensions from all directions, you somehow go from very high dimension, pop, and you have another point here. So you're changing the shape for particular elements of this convex. I mean, so this is really, you should think of this coming down as a convex combination of two negative elements which are orthogonal to the blackboard in some sense. Yeah? So that's happened. I mean, I can make this more precise. So let me just introduce a norm on the whole space, and that is by using this typical 2x2 matrix like X and X star. And so there are some relations between these norms. If you put L1 inside, they're the same. So this is cool. King and Colden proved that LP of LQ is contained in LP of LQ. So this is the Carlin-Leib definition, and that's the PGA definition. So we have at least one inclusion. And the inclusion is strict, if I'm not remembering incorrectly, but I think we will learn about this. This is for Q equals 2. And then by preparing for this talk, I talked with Xu from Besançon, and we found out that in the missing range, that's also not okay. I mean, there are also strict inequalities. And that's essentially what's happening is something very weird. You see, I mean, we have taken this PDA definition with some asymmetry to the left and to the right. But these new column leaf spaces, they have the property that you can also get asymmetric results. So we have the same Q in the middle, but here different parameters. And that's not difficult to show, interpolation, whatever. And whenever you get that, yeah, so this space here is very different from the original definition where this is symmetric. And you can easily test this on column vectors, right? So the inclusion is also strict in those cases, which I think is complementary to their results, but the technique is relatively elementary. And of course, the important thing here is that R equals S. And what we proved before is that there is no norm on the cells of space of self-adjoint elements, because this here was supposed to be on the space of self-adjoint elements. So this is something we have seen this morning. So we are talking here, X is a space of self-adjoint elements. And here are the positive elements, and here are again the negative elements, and we have these unit balls coming from the set of all positive elements with the norms less than 1. And then we are taking the minus cone, and so what this gives here is a norm on the set of self-adjoint elements. Yeah? Just by definition, it's a norm on the space of self-adjoint elements, and this one here. But we show that for every norm on the space of self-adjoint elements, essentially, it never is equivalent to the original expression. So there is no norm on the self-adjoint elements, so that if I restrict it to positive element, I get this expression given by the Carlin-Leap concrete expression. So this, whenever you have a norm, you will never find this line. You will always find something else. Yeah, so this is, of course, if you think of positive elements in a lattice, then, of course, a positive element has the same norm in the just considered inside the positive elements, and so this is somehow screwed up. There is no norm. What is probably more interesting is how we do this. We use a tensor product trick, so somehow if the constant were to be, if we have a finite, if the constant is finite, then the constant has to be 1. That's a tensor product trick. And then, of course, we use the central limit argument. Namely, we want to calculate phi to the x q 1 over q for an arbitrary completely positive map. You know? So for an arbitrary completely positive map, we could actually define these new mixed LP of LQ norms. They still are convex because there is an embedding in the original one. And the embedding, you could prove this directly by applying the Leap-Carlin argument. But what we see is actually for a given x, we can find nice homomorphisms. And then take the sum of these Q norms of these homomorphisms, and then in the limit you exactly get this expression, and this can be done with free probability or classical probability. It's really a central limit argument, and so if these guys here would coincide, then if these guys here would be equivalent to a norm, then these here have to be equivalent to a norm, yeah, because the subspace is a norm. Right, the subspace of a subspace gives a norm. And so, and what is actually nice is that these PKs can be constructed explicitly using the Krauss or whatever Choi operators for phi. You just write it down explicitly, and then you construct a nice unitary, and it's entirely elementary. I mean, the construction of these PK of X are really elementary. I think that's all I have to say.